Good morning, Your Honors. Joseph Jeruzza on behalf of the appellant Rolando Paez. In this case, the court granted my client a certificate of appealability, asking whether the district court erred in determining that Paez's Section 2254 petition was filed 68 days after the AEDPA statute of limitations based on its time calculations derived without obtaining the state court record. I advanced two arguments in my brief. The first, that the district court committed Clisby error when it failed to make a record for this court's review. And second, that the district court erred in taking judicial notice of adjudicative facts when it reviewed the state trial court docket instead of reviewing the actual state court filings of the appellant. Now, in respect to the first argument, in 2019, it is very common for courts to use and judges to use hyperlinks to documents outside of a court record. It's very common, and it's replete both at the Supreme Court level and in some courts of appeals and even at trial courts. However, we have a problem. This problem is known as link rot. Hyperlinks to documents outside of a court record are not static. There are times where they get broken, they change, things happen. Indeed, the DC Circuit in July of 2015 stated in a press release, quote, "This circuit's opinions frequently contain citations to web pages. Unfortunately, after a period of time, some of those web pages cease to exist or become altered, making a citation inaccessible or indiscernible." Likewise, the United States Supreme Court, starting in the October session of 2015, addressed this link rot problem and has now portions of court opinions that are available in hard copy with the clerk's office and are also available online. How that relates,
Mr. DeRosa, excuse me for interrupting you, but one thing I'm from Georgia, where we have 159 counties with their separate systems. I understand in Florida it's 67 counties. Is that
at the county court level? I believe there's 67, but then some of the counties are merged for the circuit level. Some counties have a circuit, so the number's less. I want to say 19 circuits.
My question is, you know, how reliable are the dockets across the state? Is it pretty consistent in terms of practices? I mean, I worry about maybe some dockets that we're referring to are not as reliable as others.
Well, in my experience, and I'll be first to admit that I almost exclusively do federal practice now. When I was a baby lawyer and was a state public defender, I only practice in one county, one circuit, Broward County, Fort Lauderdale. So I haven't had a whole lot of experience statewide. But what I can tell you is that, at least in my experience, the docket notations of the clerks who make them are not entirely indicative of the actual filings that are made by either the attorneys or, in particular, by pro se litigants. So to the extent that a trial judge, especially a federal trial judge, is going to rely upon a docket sheet of a state court and rely upon the docket notations without drilling down into the underlying document itself, I think we have a problem.
To that end, have you checked the timeline that the magistrate judge relied on? I mean, as far as you can tell, were the dates accurate that the magistrate judge relied on?
As far as I can tell, but to be perfectly honest, I really didn't drill down that much, given that the court's COA was limited. I understand that the appellee makes much ado that I didn't claim that, to the extent that there was any error, the error was prejudicial. But given the limited nature of the COA, I didn't believe that was in my purview in order to address that.
I mean, one of the things that worries me about this is that, you know, the time defense, you know, if that it's too late, is an affirmative defense. And so what we're dealing with is where a court has basically asserted an affirmative defense on behalf of the government. I mean, what are your thoughts about that?
Well, I personally believe that's problematic, given that the Supreme Court is very clear that affirmative defense is a claim processing rule. It's not a threshold jurisdictional. Under Holland v. Florida, we've got equitable tolling issues in 2254s. Also, I believe it's under Schlupp v. I forget the other party. That Supreme Court case says we have an actual innocence exception to the one-year 2254 time bar. So we have this confluence of outs, so to speak, for a state court petitioner that would allow them to get around the one-year time bar. So when you add all these things in together, I personally find it problematic for not only trial court to raise it sua sponte, assuming that they could, but then not directing the parties themselves to drill down into it. And I would submit that the best practice would be for a state or for a federal district court to order the state to provide an appendix, which in my experience before this court on 2254s is the common practice for the state to provide an appendix full of the state court documents that then becomes part of the record. And as a result, then we don't have this this problem with a deficient record for this court's review. Now, but going back to my link rot problem, I don't suggest that citing to documents outside of a court is problematic. I would suggest that if a trial court wants to do that, or even if this court, I've looked at this court's general rules or general orders, also looked at the Fourth Circuit's, and it seems to me that the D.C. Circuit is at this time the only one that has this rule following the Supreme Court. But I would submit that if a trial court wants to take a state court document like a docket and cite to it, that's fine, but it should also print it to a PDF, make it part of the district court's record, which then can all go up to this court for review. And this is especially important for purposes of dockets, because dockets grow, dockets change. There are the possibilities that years after the fact, you might have a sealing order, you might have dockets that are placed into archives, which are then no longer available for public view. You typically see that in context of newspaper articles where they might be available for 30 days, but after a certain amount of time, they're placed behind a firewall and you don't have access to them. Or you have other possibilities where the state docket might just get moved to a different part of the website, so a URL that you had before, when you click on it, it doesn't lead you anywhere. So this would prevent that, which is why I believe the Supreme Court and the DC Circuit found that not only providing the hyperlinks, but providing the underlying documents really to be the best practice. What I would submit, this court should take the lead and adopt that rule, not only I would hope at the circuit level, but also suggesting that at the trial level, because the problem that we have in this case is not indicative just of Section 2254 cases. You could find them also in 1983 cases and a whole host of both criminal and civil cases.
Is what you're saying that you want the magistrate judge in this case, he's going to rely on documents to produce them, put them in the record, so that everybody knows, including your client, what's being relied on?
Exactly. A very simple print to PDF and then do some type of filing that supports the trial court's or the R&R's opinion. And then we all know what he's looking at as of the date that he looked at it.
What access does a prisoner have to documents? If he, for example, they're produced, he disagrees with one or doesn't believe that's a controlling document. What access does a prisoner have to these issues?
It's my understanding that the ability of a state court, of a state prisoner in the Florida Department of Corrections to access the internet is limited, and I believe that limitation depends upon your security classifications, but I would admit that I'm not an expert on that. But going back, you know, to your point, Judge Traxler, a judge can print to PDF, and then it becomes part of the record, and then we all know, and then it can go to the petitioner himself, where he can look at it and say something is wrong, something is not right, which is actually what happened in this case. After the R&R came out, my client filed an objection to the R&R, and into the objection, the R&R contested the actual factual assertions in the R&R, which then the district court, resolved, unfortunately, against my client. But I would submit that when you have a trial court committee producing an R&R, taking judicial notice of certain facts, which then my client contested, I don't believe that on a cold record a district court can resolve that. I believe that it would require additional fact-finding and potentially a hearing, especially when my client made an actual innocence claim to get around the one-year time bar.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning. My name is Janine Jimenowit. I'm here today to represent the state of Florida, the Department of Corrections in this matter. It is, of course, our position that, first of all, this issue was waived. Second of all, the petitioner quite clearly, untimely, on his face, which the magistrate judge then confirmed by going to the docket sheet and looking at them and confirming those dates that set forth in the petition. And then also, we would submit that there was no error to begin with, and that if any error, it is clearly harmless because the petition is quite clearly untimely. Now, in terms of the petition being untimely on its face, if you look at the petition and you look at the date that is set forth in the petition, you will see by looking at those dates that there is a gap, and that gap renders this petition untimely on its face. Now, the magistrate judge went above and beyond what Rule 4 requires, which is to say that the magistrate judge went and looked online and confirmed that those were the dates that were in fact correct. And then where the dates on the docket differed from what the petitioner represented in her sworn petition under the penalties of perjury, that these dates were correct, the magistrate judge then gave the defendant the benefit of the doubt and said, I'm accepting your date, the date on which you filed that petition, or in this case, the date on which you filed your motion for post-conviction relief. I'm accepting that. And having accepted that, it's quite clear that the petitioner is untimely. Now, in terms of the adequacy of the record to support the finding, first of all, again, the petition is untimely on its face. The magistrate judge provides sufficient citation to the petition itself, but the magistrate judge then also provides citation to the documents. He makes it clear what documents he's relying on, and then he provides web addresses for those documents.
Just in general, your brother in this case has proposed this idea that there should be a PDF of the documents that the magistrate judge relied on, and then everybody knows exactly, everybody's relying on the same facts. I mean, that seems like a reasonable proposition. If you were making a rule, would you object to that being the rule?
Certainly, if there, the belt and suspenders approach is always, the wonderful approach where you, in addition to citing to the documents, you also provide a PDF, that would be wonderful. But the fact of the matter is that the magistrate judge did what he needed to do. There's nothing out there that says that a record has to be in a particular format. And in fact, it's interesting because the state of Florida, all of the official court files are now in electronic format. They're maintained by the state courts of Florida and the ordinary courts of business. And so those electronics are the official records for the state of Florida.
Do you know if the records are kept fairly consistently across the 19 judicial circuits in Florida? On the docket?
And I can say that the 19th Circuit seemed to be pretty consistent in terms of providing correct dates and so forth on the petition. And I'm sorry, I keep saying petitions, but I mean dockets. They do seem to be pretty consistent about providing correct dates. They seem to maintain the record well.
And everyone does electronic dockets. All of these courts across Florida do electronic dockets.
Yeah. and that's the future, that's where we're going. And so that's the reason why we think that in this case, there's no reason to suggest that the state courts of Florida are suddenly going to switch base and say, well, no, we're changing everything. You can't have these documents anymore. That's not the case. They're going to continue to maintain that in the future. So we don't think that that is a concern. Now, in terms of this particular case, opposing counsel and I have both looked at the actual records in addition to looking at the documents, and on the particular dates that are relied on by the magistrate judge to specifically determine the issue of timeliness, it's quite clear that those dates are correct. Now, first of all, there are three important dates. One of them is the date of the defendant's 3850 motion when he filed that motion. But the second and third dates that are important are orders, dates on which orders were issued. Now, the docketing date of the date on which an order was issued is going to be the same as the filing date. But we do concede that in terms of pro se prisoners, the filing date is different from the docketing date in the sense that the filing date is the date that they turn their motion over to prison officials for mailing. But in this particular case, what the magistrate judge would rely on the sworn representation of this particular petitioner who said that this date, this document was filed on this day. The magistrate judge said, okay, this date is different from the docketing day. However, I'm going to give you the benefit of the doubt. I'm going to assume that this is the filing day pursuant to the mailbox rule. In fact, that is correct. I've looked at those documents. I believe defense counsel has looked at that document because he cited to it in his statement of the facts. It's the same day. So in this particular case, quite clearly untimely. So regardless of whether there's error, we submit there is no error. But if there was error, it's quite clearly harmless.
Ms. Germanowicz, what about my concern about allowing the magistrate judge to assert an affirmative defense on behalf of the government? That worries me a little bit. Does it worry you?
No, because Rule 4 specifically says that it appears from the face of the petition that it is untimely, then, or some other procedural bar exists, then they are entitled to rely on that to dismiss. And Rule 4 says that if it plainly appears from the petition in any attached exhibit that the petitioner is not entitled to relief in the district court, the judge must dismiss the petition and direct the clerk to notify the petitioner. Now, you may say that, you know, well, wait a minute, that's not fair to the defendant because the defendant doesn't have a chance to say, well, judge, you're wrong. But in fact, the defendant does have a chance to say, judge, you're wrong. The defendant has the chance to file objections to the magistrate report. And he says, magistrate, this date that you relied on is wrong. But he didn't do that in this case.
That's not exactly what I'm worried about. I have been involved in cases where a petition was not timely filed, but the government was willing to waive the statute of limitations defense. And so if you have one of these cases where the court kicks it out without the government ever knowing about it, then the government's ability to waive the statute of limitations defense is gone, and it is an affirmative defense.
Well, first of all, that's an assumption that the state would be willing to waive that defense if, in fact, we have been responding. Of course, we would not have wanted to waive that defense. But I would point you to the case of Long, which is one of the cases that opposing counsel cited. And in that case, it's interesting because the state actually conceded in that case that the petition was timely. But then the district court, I believe, was looking at it, and the district court said, hey, the calculation doesn't seem correct. And so after looking at it, the district court ultimately found that the petition is untimely in that case, and that was affirmed. And so it's exactly the same type of situation where the district court is quite clearly able to do that regardless of whether the state responds or not, either before or after the state has filed a response. The district court still has the option of saying, look, this petition is untimely, it's procedurally barred, I'm going to dismiss it, and dismiss it in despite of the state's waiver and long. So it's possible.
Can I ask you, interrupt you just a second to ask your question? My understanding in this case is that the magistrate judge took it upon himself or herself to go and to raise the defense, to go and research the record, gather the records, and then make a determination. My question would be, let's suppose we said this is okay. Could a magistrate then direct the government to raise the defense and tell the government, I'm ordering you to raise this defense, I'm ordering you to go get all the records and report back to me whether or not there's been a violation of the statute of limitations? Could a magistrate judge do that?
I think that the magistrate judge has the ability to issue an order to the state to address the issue of the statute of limitations. Yeah, they do have the ability to do that.
It could order the government to raise the defense. It could order the government to raise the defense and to do the research and report it to the court.
He certainly could order, the magistrate judge certainly can order the government to respond on the statute of limitations. That's not a problem. And the district court judge can still say, I'm not accepting the state waiver of the statute of limitations, for example, as in Long. But the magistrate judge and the district court judge also don't even need to ask the state to respond at all under Rule 4, the rule governing Section 2254 cases, and also Section 2243, which says if it appeared from the application that the applicant or person is not entitled to further review, then they can dismiss. I hope that answers your question.
Well, I could easily see a situation where a magistrate judge, faced with an overwhelming caseload, doesn't have the time to do all this, but wants it checked, and so he tells the government, you do the work. I'm telling you, go do the work. And then suppose the government says, I don't want to raise this defense. It's an affirmative defense. For whatever reason, I don't want to raise it. Then you get into a big problem.
You've
got the magistrate wanting to do it. The government doesn't want to. It's an affirmative defense. And then you get in a big brouhaha over who's got to go do this, if anybody.
Well, no. Again, in the normal course of events, the magistrate judge issues the state an order to the state to respond and say why the habeas corpus should not be granted. It's usually a generic order, not necessarily directed to the statute of limitations. And then the state comes back and they file a response, and generally speaking, they'll address the statute of limitations in that response. But again, I keep going back to Long, because in that case, the state actually waived the statute of limitations defense, and the district court came back and said, no, I think that your calculations are wrong, and therefore I'm going to not accept your waiver, and I'm going to dismiss this petition as untimely. That's exactly what happened in Long. So regardless of the situation that you're describing, I don't think it's a problem, because the district court, the magistrate judge, can both choose to disregard any waiver from the state on that defense. I'm not saying the magistrate judge can tell the state to, for example, I want you to tell me that this petition is untimely. I don't think they can tell them to do that. I think they can say, well, I'd like you to discuss the issue of untimeliness. Is this petition untimely or is it not? So anything that the magistrate judge is not acting as an advocate for the state, if that's what you're concerned about. But the rules themselves specifically say that independent of what happened with the state, independent of if they even issue an order on or in order to the state to respond, independent of that, they can independently determine whether the petition is untimely or procedurally barred in some other way.
Okay, I think I understand your answer.
Okay.
Thank you.
Is there any, I see that I'm running out of time. Is there any other questions that you might want me to address before I...
Okay, you've talked me into it. another thing that worries me is how a magistrate judge or a district judge, for that matter, looking at a cold docket, how are they going to know about things like the mailbox rule? They're not going to be able to tell from the docket when the prisoner gave the filing to prison authorities for mailing, and sometimes these calculations come down to just a couple of days. So that seems like a problem to me as well. Does it to you?
Yes, admittedly, that might be a concern. In another case, this is not that case. The defendant made a sworn representation that his motion for post-conviction relief was filed on X day. So the magistrate judge was entitled to rely on the defendant's sworn representation. And the magistrate judge noted that it differed from the docket date, and he said, I'm giving you the benefit of the doubt. I'm accepting that that's when he filed it. And so in this particular case, there was no issue.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
And picking back up on Judge Traxler's last thread, I believe that it is problematic for the court to direct or to, in essence, sua sponte, raise an affirmative defense. I believe that one that intrudes upon the litigant's prerogative, but in a Section 2254 case, I believe that also intrudes upon the sovereign's prerogative, which I find to be particularly troubling. Now, I would like to draw the distinction between a 2254 and other types of statutes. For example, tax statutes. 2254 and the habeas provisions, these are not jurisdictional statutes, unlike tax statutes that are jurisdictional. I can understand why a district court or a magistrate might ask for a litigant to brief an issue of statute of limitations on a tax matter because that's a jurisdictional threshold consideration that a district court would have to consider. But those considerations don't come into play here. So in this context, I don't believe it's appropriate for a magistrate judge to raise sua sponte an affirmative defense, nor would I believe it be appropriate for the magistrate judge to tell the state of Florida or any other sovereign within our constitutional design to raise an affirmative defense because, for example, the state of Florida might determine they don't want to raise the very difficult calculation. They just might have a very good argument that it's not an unreasonable application of established Supreme Court law, and the path of least resistance for the state might be, let me get a merits-based determination, not have to go down this rabbit hole of a procedural. So I think, you know, answering your question, Judge Traxler, I think that's problematic.
Why doesn't Day answer that question, though? Why doesn't Day say the courts can do it on their own initiative?
I don't know. My initial reaction is perhaps Day might have been before the sea change in jurisdictional versus claims processing rules. And I want to say Day might have been before Holland v. Florida. So I think that perhaps, you know, to the extent there's some tension, you know, that issue would have to be worked out. But to be perfectly frank, I really haven't worked that out through my head. But going back to the Rule 4 issue that my colleague brought up, I understand why you have on the face of petition that that Rule 4 allows a court to effectively dismiss a petition if it's apparent on its face that it lacks merit or there's some procedural obstacle. I just don't see, though, how Rule 4 could ever apply to a claim of actual innocence. I think a claim of actual innocence, I don't know how that can just be dismissed on its face, especially within the context of a pro se litigant. Now, going back to a thread you had, Judge Martin, I'm not aware of, because I don't practice in Alabama or Georgia, but I would think that this court would also have to take into consideration those trial court dockets and the quality of the dockets throughout those other states. But in as for Florida goes, this court also needs to take into consideration the intermediate courts of appeal, the district courts of appeal. It's my experience in that the dockets do not have hyperlinks or availability to view the filings. So, for example, the third DCA here in Miami, you can go onto the docket, you can see the docket entries and what they are, but you are unable to click on the actual document itself and actually view it. So again, this leads back to the problem we have, where you have a docket sheet, and we have a docket sheet that has hyperlinks. I can understand where the concerns are somewhat minimized, but where you have a docket sheet by itself and you don't actually get to view or drill down into the actual underlying court filing, I find that to be highly problematic, and I would hope that that court or this court would give that consideration as well. So in all, I would submit that this court should take the lead, similar to what the DC Circuit and what the Supreme Court has done, and just have a very simple rule. And I understand that to date, nothing has actually been said by this court as to what the record needs to be and what particular format. But I would urge this court to say that going forward, that to the extent that a trial court is going to rely upon another court's docket sheet or document, that it print to PDF and include it as part of the record, so that we don't have to have these types of arguments and problems, especially which are indicative in 2254 cases. So that being said, I ask the court to reverse and remand with instructions for further factual development below. Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right, I'm going to follow your lead.